My guest is comic Graham Chapman. Chapman was a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, the six-man British comedy group which broke up audiences at home and abroad with their performances on TV, films, and records. The Pythons created a comic style based on surrealistic wordplay. Chapman was memorable in some of the group's classic sketches.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings!
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit! Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert!
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
Oh! Oh, I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see. Well, that explains...
Ah, yes. You want room 12A, just along the corridor.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Stupid git.
That was Graham Chapman dishing out the abuse. In addition to being an inspired comic writer and actor, Chapman is a trained physician, a gay rights activist, and a recovering alcoholic. If you've lost track of him since the group split up, he's been a stand-up comic, a lecturer, author, and film producer. I asked Chapman if his early TV sketches with Monty Python were considered too risque or eccentric.
Well, the BBC, to begin with, didn't like us very much, which was actually strangely in our favour, because they put us out at a very unpopular hour of the evening, late on a Sunday night, which is not a top slot in Britain. Also, they frequently preempted us with important things like horse show jumping. They generally didn't rate us very highly, which was good because that meant they didn't even bother to read the scripts. So that meant we could do more or less as we wanted. It wasn't until towards the end of the second series of programmes that they began to realise that we were picking up quite an audience. And then, of course, they began to read the scripts, and that did lead to one or two problems. Naughty words, really. Just silly, childish, naughty words that they would find objectionable, I suppose, because they probably had a problem with their early toilet training, the BBC.
That must be it.
Yes, I think so. Found sensitive areas. But we had then a sort of precedent to point to. We could say, but we said that in programme 3 or whatever, and they would listen to it and found out that we had, and they had no complaints. And so, you know, we could say, we can say it again then.
I think that there's a lot of British humour and Monty Python-type humour that a lot of Americans don't necessarily get because the language is so different?
Yes, I suppose there are. Although we were quite fortunate in that respect, in that during the whole TV series, we tended not, on the whole, to use topical humour. So that has meant that it is relatively timeless, at least, although there obviously are one or two specific things that that will be pretty meaningless now. And also, because of the area and where we were filming or where we were performing these sketches and the local dialects, things might be at first pretty meaningless to an American audience, we imagine certainly. But they seem to pick up on it and to persist and indeed find translations if they can't understand them first off.
There's never been any that I know of women in the group.
Well, there was Carol Cleveland, who used to play the female roles when we needed a real female.
Was it more
person.
Fun to have the men play the women than to get women in the group?
Not so much the fun. It was cheaper. That was the most important factor. There were just six of us involved with the programme, writing it and performing it on the whole. And the BBC, as I said before, didn't like us very much. They didn't give us a very large budget. So we had to try and keep casting down to a minimum. We played, therefore, as many roles as we could ourselves.
You have been a gay rights activist and, I think, edited a gay paper, gay journal.
I didn't edit it. What I did really was just to provide them with a little bit of cash in the early days so that they could get a newspaper started. There was a kind of collective which formed a newspaper called Gay News.
Was there the group was comfortable with you coming out publicly?
John Cleese was rather surprised, to say the least. In fact, I think I mentioned it to his girlfriend first, She was happy about it, but John was rather surprised. I think Jonathan Miller summed that up, John's surprise, by saying that he thought it was a bit unfair of me. After all, I was a pipe-smoking, rugby-playing mountaineer, not the obvious sort of gay person, I suppose. So it was a surprise for him. But I think he understood in the end.
A lot of the men in the group dressed in drag for certain roles.
Yes, which is actually not all that unusual in Britain, certainly. I mean, a long tradition of it going right back to Shakespeare and so on, so it didn't seem like anything particularly extraordinary.
Did people interpret that as being gay humour at all, to have men in drag?
No, it worried people in the States a little bit to begin with. I think there's a certain sensitivity because, of course, the United States male on the whole is very much more bothered about whether he's being butch enough and macho enough, you know. There's less of, I think, people are a bit more relaxed about that sort of thing in Europe, really. They're not so worried about their masculinity because they know it's there, so they don't have to prove it all the time.
Well, what's your collaborating method when you are working together?
Well, John and I wrote together. Michael Payne and Terry Jones wrote together. Eric wrote on his own, and then Terry Gilliam did all the animations and the visual side of things.
So would you lock yourself up in a room and try to write sketches together?
Yeah, well, John and I would just meet up and sit there for an hour or so, trying to avoid work at all costs, drinking cups of coffee and reading the newspapers, talking about what was in the news, maybe anything to put off that awful moment of having to put something on paper. And then about an hour before lunchtime, we'd begin to feel guilty that we hadn't done anything, and at that point we would hopefully think of something which had either occurred during that first hour or so, or if not, then in desperation open up Roger's Thesaurus and simply look at a collection of words to see if that inspired anything, which it sometimes did.
I'll bet it did, because so many of your sketches were wordplay, and it wasn't logical, but it was hysterical.
Look at the cheese shop sketch, for instance.
Oh, and the cheese
almost
dancing.
Almost directly from Roger's Thesaurus.
What did you look up that led to that?
Well, we were into cheeses anyway, so we simply looked at that point. We liked the idea of a shop which contained absolutely nothing that it claimed it sold, which is just a minor exaggeration of the way some British shops are. So that was what we were getting at, I think, and decided on cheese as being the comestible in point, and so just looked up a whole list of cheeses in Roger, added a few, and there it was.
Gouda?
No.
Edam?
No.
Caithness?
No.
Smoked Austrian?
No.
Japanese Sage Derby?
No, sir.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Of course, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir. We got...
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
Wensleydale?
Yes.
Ah, well, I'll have some of that.
Oh, I thought you were talking to me, sir. Mr. Wensleydale, that's my name.
Greek feta?
Not as such.
Gorgonzola?
No.
Parmesan?
No.
Mozzarella? Pepper crema? No. Danish...
When you're a comic writer and you're writing with a collaborator, do you laugh at each other's funny lines?
Yes, and also laugh together, too. I mean, there's one whole sketch when John and I, we perhaps had gone a bit too far, but we felt guilty about it while we were writing it, which made us laugh hysterically. And that was the Undertaker's sketch. I mean, perhaps we had gone too far. You know, people taking their dead mothers into Undertakers in a sack, you know, it's on sort of tricky ground, isn't it?
And then they had to decide if they were going to burn them,
bury them,
or dump them.
Right. Yes. That made us feel guilty, I suppose, because all the time we were thinking of our own dear mothers, and it is a bit far to go, isn't it?
Well, this is a real serious issue, I think. If you're writing humour like that, do you want your mother to hear it?
No, you don't. Fortunately, with John and I, we did frequently, I suppose, really think of our own mothers when we were writing sketches. John always used the excuse that it was my mother, and I always used the excuse that it was his. And they seem to believe that quite satisfactorily.
Are you still collaborating with John Cleese now?
Yes. I mean, it's been some 27 years now, on and off. I mean, there have been huge patches where we've been doing other things individually. But, yeah.
So are there more movies in the works?
Well, there's nothing in the works at the moment as a group. No, we're all doing our own individual things. I think we're all optimistic that there will be another movie at some point, but the difficult thing is getting six people to agree on a subject. It really is quite tricky.
Graham Chapman is a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus.